Welcome to an all-new episode of Idea Factory Radio. I'm Steve Factor, and this is the only and by far the best podcast about innovation, trends, and the future of business, your family, and even your dog. And if there are better ones, please don't tell me about it. Anyway, go to ideafactory.com. Factory is with a K instead of a C. And subscribe to the podcast. Today's the first of three parts with Mark Fidelman. Mark is an esteemed contributor to Forbes. He's also a social media guru, especially in the enterprise space, which means he makes wild, passionate love to many corporations. Actually, Mark is just a great guy. And he's also, it turns out, a sneaky guy. We were having a very candid conversation, and he ended up recording all of it. I thought you'd get a kick out of us debating and arguing and pretty much rolling in the dirt, punching each other over something completely meaningless, like how much money an app is going to make. But in either case, here's the episode. I hope you enjoy it. Go to Idea Factory and subscribe.
I think there's only 4% of employees who are trying to change things, stay extra hours, and they have to drag the other 96%.
So four out of the 100 people that work for Bright Idea are not motivated to work.
Yeah, they're motivated only to the extent that, you know, they'll get through the day, they'll get their submissions in, they'll test it as much as they can, and then they'll leave it, or they'll work to the extent that they know it will take to not get fired. It's a bad example too, because young employees are much more influenceable than older ones. This should be recorded.
It is.
Is it?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I think it's young employees are going to be much more malleable because they're just starting out. They're eager to prove themselves. They're afraid of derailing their career. They need the money because they've just moved out of their parents' house.
Well, why not just provide a great work environment for them? Why pay them anything?
I think you can pay them a lot less. It depends on how tight that particular job category is. If you're talking about someone working for MTV, you can pay them next to nothing. You could maybe every once in a while give them a pretzel. But other than that, you don't have to give them anything.
What kind of loyalty do you get out of those employees? They're going to move on?
No. Well, they will move on because the valuable ones, that you have so much upside before it hurts your pocketbook that you could double their salary and still not even feel a pinch. So you have these kids who come in, you pay them nothing because they're working for MTV. They love the ability to say they're working for MTV, any kind of desirable company. Google is the same way. And then at some point, the really, really great ones will stand out, and you can offer to increase their salary by 50%.
But Pink says just make the environment better for them.
It that does work for some people. You know who it works for? People who are in the middle of their careers, who aren't that ambitious, who care, who have bills to pay and families to support, are normally skittish about changing jobs. And then you can just do a few things on the margin to keep them and keep them pacified and satiated. But you don't have to do that much. So you can give them just a little bit, make their work a little more comfortable, maybe give them a slight bonus or make them feel more valuable.
But he also says, you know, give them work that's interesting to them.
Well, that's
you
hard.
My argument was, and I wrote about this, was you have a corporate mission.
Yeah.
If their interests are outside the corporate mission, then, I mean, this is where I kind of laugh at guys like Dan Pink, who have never been in the enterprise. If he has it, he doesn't know what the hell he's
talking
about.
No, he hasn't worked. He's been a journalist, I think.
This is the problem I have with journalists, where I think companies that have executives or employees that have actually done the work are now blogging, are more relevant. Yes, Steve. Are more relevant than, say, a journalist who's only looked at it from outside the fishbowl.
Yeah.
And so Dan, to me, I have a problem with half of what he says. The half that says make a better work environment, I like that, but it's not realistic to say just improve the workplace, improve what people like to do within the workplace, and you fix all your problems. I disagree.
I was a journalism major at NYU.
I'm sorry.
I know. Well, I changed to business at some point. I didn't graduate with a journalism degree. The thing that I've observed about journalists in general and writers they have a huge chip on their shoulder. Because in most cases, especially in business journalism, they're often covering people who are way more successful than they are. That makes them angry, and it makes them sometimes spiteful, sometimes vindictive, sometimes just angry. And they see things through a jealousy type of lens in some cases.
So these are the ones that are painting picketing signs outside the Wall Street.
Yeah, I don't know
Wall
if those
Street.
Are journalists. I think a lot of the
journalists certainly covered it.
They
and
did.
They're always
and
talking
they had
about
a lot
the
of
1%ers.
They have a lot of sympathy
yeah.
towards them because they
this is class warfare that these journalists are promoting out there.
Well.
Or at least covering more so than not covering it, right? And that's their subtle prejudice that they put out there.
Think about just the reality of the profession of journalism. The written word has been devalued to next to nothing. And even media in general, in most cases, people don't make money at it anymore. There's not 10 channels anymore, there's 1,000 channels, and then there's stuff online. Everything is competing, and it's driving the price down to zero, which means it's driving their salaries and their opportunities down to zero. Mm-hmm. They're in a shrinking market, but they perceive that they have a skill and an ability that a lot of them have invested in by paying for ridiculously expensive schools. I went to NYU. If NYU charges $40,000 for a journalism degree a year, they should be in prison. Seriously, that is theft. That is pure theft because they know the reality that there is no money. Now, the only exception is if you are rich and you have rich parents, or you're extremely hot and plan to marry someone who is rich and can support you. But those would be all of the above. Though that should be the only criteria. You should get an application. Oh, do you want to? If journalism, you know how on the tax form, if you answer yes to the question, there's three other questions. Yeah. So if you answer yes, I want to major in journalism, the next three questions should be, are you hot? Two, are your parents rich? And three, how rich will your future spouse be? Or do you expect your...
Please take this psychology test if you answer yes.
That's right. That should be the test, because otherwise they are thieves and they should be in prison, because they know the realities of the journalism world, and they know that forget about all the other schools. If NYU was the only, and I'm using them as an example, it's not just NYU, there's a lot of Columbia School and so on, but if NYU was the only school that produced journalists, there might still be a surplus. That's how few paying jobs there are. Now, you could turn your thing into other forms of monetization and into jobs.
That's what an Arrington would do, right? You take that his influence and start a venture capital fund.
That's exactly what he's done.
Yeah, but you don't have to start a venture capital fund. You could trade it for what I advocate is become the chief evangelist of an organization. You bring your following, especially if you write for a big organization. And I am certain that they should be paid quite a lot of money. If you just quantify, Steve, just quantify the amount of money companies spend on marketing and PR and replace that with one individual, maybe it's a journalist that you pay $200,000, $250,000 to, maybe even more depending on who you are, you'll have a huge amount of savings and much more benefit.
One
by
journalist
employing.
Is getting $250,000.
No, what I'm saying is journalists should trade their following, their influence, their ability to communicate for a corporate job and become a chief evangelist.
No, that's terrible.
Why is that terrible?
That is horrible.
Why? Tell me why.
Because it ruins independence. You're bastardizing the idea.
You can't have independence anyway. These journalists, are you kidding me? They're impacted by advertisers. They're impacted by their buddies. They're impacted by, you know, I think that definitely the media is definitely liberal slanting. So they're impacted. Every time they go into a cocktail party, they don't want to write about things that are anti-democratic or anti-liberal.
But hold on.
They're already influenced just in other ways.
They are. However, because there's so much competition in the field and there's so many outlets and venues, that is a mechanism to keep them honest. That competition for the story or for the scoop or for the angle creates a need to go there, even though if they just existed in isolation and subject to their sponsors' whims, then they wouldn't cover those stories. But
what's the difference between being sponsored by one big corporation versus many corporations in the traditional journalist model?
Well, I don't think it's just about your organization or just about you. I think it's about...
No, one organization would pay your salary. You're still free to talk about anything that's related to your area of expertise, but occasionally write about us, write the corporation, or represent us. It's kind of this branded
journalism.
Well,
that's the Scoble model, right? So
exactly.
Scoble works for Rackspace.
Exactly.
And he
writes about all sorts of startups. But guess what? Rackspace could sell cloud services to any one of those startups that he's talking to, and everybody knows it. So he's providing a net benefit to society as well as an opportunity for Rackspace to sell cloud services.
What is the benefit to society exactly?
Well, I mean, depending on if you like Scoble or not, I have
to. I have nothing against him. I think he's a very likable guy. I
learn
just
about
wonder,
all these
what is
startups?
The benefit to society?
Well, because I think a lot of people learn about these startups that he writes about and decides whether there's some value to their organization or not, whether to engage with one of the startups he's covering or not. For me, it's invaluable.
I look at these apps. He covers things that are easy and in most cases dumb. To give that much attention to not that he's dumb, he's smart, but the apps themselves aren't businesses. You look at Flickr. Flickr's not making money. And there are all these tiny little apps that give you ways to manipulate photos. Photographers are starving. And some guy with an app is going to monetize that around photography. Good luck.
Well, Instagram seems to be doing
that. No, but Instagram doesn't make any money.
Yet.
What do you mean yet? This is the fallacy of this thinking that we have right now. We think that just because you build it and you get a million people to use it, that you're going to be able to monetize it. Well, what if the monetization thing is 120 degrees away from the thing that you're doing now?
Then you have to find some creative people to figure out how to monetize it. Twitter's falls into that category,
yeah, and
right?
Twitter hasn't made money.
Yes, I know. But they'll figure out a way to make money.
Everyone says that. But they've been bleeding money ever since.
So then they need some management changeover.
I mean,
why are they continuing to bleed out? Personally, I would turn into an analytics company. Because
that's where they're going.
Okay, there you go. Because there's so much big data
that
corporations will buy and sell. Just like from the credit card companies. These companies are buying from the credit cards.
Yeah.
The same thing will happen with Twitter. But even more importantly, you'll know quite a lot about people that you don't get from credit card transactions.
It's still limited. There is...
It's a big enough business for Twitter.
No. It's a big enough business for a small business that didn't have as much sunk capital and venture funding as they did. They're never going to monetize, or from what I could see, being on the path that they're on, at the level that the expectations and the venture capital expected them to.
Well, I don't know. If you're talking dollars and cents, I'd better understand that. But, I mean, if you look at Omniture, which was bought by Adobe for $800 million.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a pretty good return. I don't know what
200. I'm trying to think how much Twitter's raised. I think I read a number. I don't remember this exactly. Somewhere in the 200-something million range.
Okay. So they're going to look for... Really? They're going to look for a $2.5 billion exit.
That's
minimum.
Right. Do you think it's a $2.5 billion company?
Not today. But I think with big data, I mean Twitter's going to grow, right? And the amount of data that they're probably surfacing could be immense. Let me give you a scenario. What if Twitter came to you and said, American Express, here are the people using Visa that we think would be better off using American Express just because of the location, what they're talking about, who they are, the profile.
I'll give you a real-life example. Amex just did a deal with I don't know if it's a deal directly with Twitter, but they have a thing now where if you promote with a tweet an Amex deal, you get that deal.
Yeah.
I don't remember exactly.
It's Amex and then Whole Foods, and then if you spend more than $75, you get a credit. And they did that with Foursquare too.
Which to me is a pollutant. To me, it is a huge pollutant into the system.
Why?
So let's say I'm following 30 people.
Yeah.
People whose opinions I value. Those people have invested, theoretically,
mm-hmm.
into building up a certain image for themselves, being being thought of as a thought leader or someone who provides interesting links or
mm-hmm.
articles or you know, as much perspective as you can in 140 characters. And then suddenly, this smart, respected person is going, "Ooh, I just saved $40 at Whole Foods."
Now, wait a second. Now, you and I are having a conversation. I can't tell you that I just saved, you know, $25 in buying, you know, this microphone. We wouldn't have that conversation.
If
I think we would have that conversation.
Okay.
It's just taking place on Twitter, so you have a problem with it.
Here's my hypothesis. If you have enough of that going on, it's going to be a turnoff to people. Because right now there's no mechanism to fine-tune it to get only things that are relevant to you. What if I live nowhere near a Whole Foods? The only thing near me is a Walmart and a little Quickie Mart with a guy whose accent I don't understand. That's the only thing near me. Then it's useless to you. However,
I agree if it's a continuous stream. I just don't think people are going to Whole Foods every day and spending $75.
Well,
I don't think that's happening.
But if enough companies chase that down, it's not just going to be Whole Foods. It's going to be, oh, here's my Whole Food deal. Here's my this deal. Here's my that deal. And so you cloud and pollute this thing that was a relevant communication medium with marketing messages that at some point is going to be a turnoff to people.
Well, then I use Hootsuite to follow, I filter that out, and I follow certain hashtags.
That's you. But you're a power user.
But eventually everybody will be power users. Oh, it'll become easier to become a power user so you can filter some of those things out. So I think that's what will happen.
It's creating a whole level of work that some people will go through and others will just go, I'll go move on to something else that isn't as invasive.
Yeah, and I think Twitter does have to watch that. I mean, Twitter can't really control that, right?
They are going to kill whatever cow or goose, or I was going to mix my animals. I was going to say cow that laid the golden egg, but cash cow.
Isn't Facebook at risk of doing the same thing, just visually?
Absolutely.
Just with ads? And
Facebook is, in my opinion, when they opened up the spigot to subscriptions, I think that was could have been and may still be a jump the shark kind of moment. What I mean by that is Facebook started out as this personal thing that only, first it was a club that you could only get into if you were part of a school or a particular school. Then it was all schools, and then it was everybody. Then it became a thing where now strangers have taken over your feed. Now I open up my feed.
Unfriend them.
No, and that's what I've been doing, and I think people will be doing more of that. But I think that the more complicated something gets, and keep in mind, these are extremely well-funded companies. What happens in a well-funded company is you start to take on employees because you got the money and you think you're going to improve your product.
Sure.
And those employees, once they're there, they have to do something, right? They can't just sit and not work. They have to go and work. And that they're going to create product and they're going to create a proliferation of product just because of how much money Facebook has to invest in product.
Mm-hmm.
And that proliferation is exactly the risk because it starts, it has no choice but to divert you from your core values and your core value proposition. And the more you divert, the more dilution there is and the more opportunities there are for others to come back in and say, look, we're going to make this network all about family. And you know what? And maybe that network gets polluted and they move on to the next greenfield.
I just think that's bad management. I mean,
That's how things, things go.
I understand, you know, how that all, but eventually it gets to some kind of a norm. Would you agree?
When a company stabilizes at a certain level where it's not funded by VCs, when it's not pressured to grow, I think, yes, when you're a cash cow type of company,
mm-hmm.
and then you go out of business for different reasons, right?
Yeah.
Because you didn't innovate
fast
enough. Yeah. You didn't upgrade your product. You rusted on your laurels.
Shitty at marketing.
Yeah, you overlooked some new way of doing things because you were tied down to legacy systems or some old way of thinking. That is why you're going to go out of business. But there's different ways. We saw Friend, was it Friend Finder? No, it was MySpace, then Friendster, and now Facebook. And those companies are all good. They were good for their time. And then something came along that was just better. Facebook is, I think, really smart and really inventive in the way that they seeded the web with all of their like buttons and you know, they did the same thing that Google did with analytics. Google's like, yeah, here's free analytics. You know exactly who's visiting your website, where they're coming from, who they're clicking
to.
And
so will we.
Yeah, and so will we. Exactly. And Facebook has this and so will we approach as well. And I think that's really smart. And that's what's going to keep them in business. But they still have to maintain that balance. That balance can go cockeyed really quickly.
Well, I think the analytics will help them understand that. And that's why I think another good reason for Twitter to become an analytics company, because they'll see those analytics and they'll understand that they need to pivot back more to a balanced position.
Yeah. I don't spend a lot of time worrying about Facebook just because I think Mark Zuckerberg is going to be okay. He's not going to have to worry about making a buck. He's a smart guy. He's a billionaire. I think me worrying about him is a little bit besides the point. In general, though, I think there's a lot of opportunity here. But, you know, you go back to where we started this conversation with
Dan Pink.
Well, Dan Pink, but just the journalists or people who are pushing these technologies. There's not a lot of real businesses here. There are very few, unless you're the platform owner and lots of other people build businesses on top of you, you're going to be hard-pressed to find any apps other than a couple of games that have made lots of money. And even those games have a limited lifespan because the games aren't that complicated. They're not that pervasive where you're not just going to go, okay, I get it.
Yeah.
I'm done tossing Angry Birds.
No, I've actually written about this actually just recently. It was quite well received, where if you look at the amount of app developers that are actually making money, it's a very small sliver.
Yeah.
And guess what? You know, the Apples, the Googles, the Amazons,
they're making money off all of them.
No matter what.
Exactly. So, exactly.
And they're only promoting the winners.
That's right.
So there's not a lot of benefit for developing an app nowadays.
No.
So my argument was the app platform providers have to have more skin in the game. They should have more risk.
Why?
Exactly. Well, that's what they say. But what I'm just saying, people are going to figure out this economic equation.
Yeah.
That they're not making shit.
Yeah.
And they need to stop developing apps for your platform because they're not making any money on it.
It's
how Microsoft got so big is they helped people developing software applications for Windows become successful. That's how they got so big.
Yeah. But this is a numbers game. Apps are a numbers game. It's different in enterprise. You're only going to use, there are use cases for Microsoft applications or applications that run on Windows.
Yeah.
There are some use cases for apps that run on your phone, but very few that would cause you to pay. And then because of the surplus of app developers, there's a pretty good chance you'll get a free app that will do 80% of what you need to do without paying. So you can come in and go, I'm going to develop the best word processor.
Why would you develop a free app when eventually you're not being paid for it?
Well, you're going to develop a free app. You're not going to set out maybe to develop a free app. Some people do free apps just because they're learning to code. Some people
That eventually goes away, right? I mean, there has to be an economic return at some point.
No, they're just going to go somewhere else. They're going to find some other field or some other platform or somewhere else to develop.
No, but I think word is going to get out that nobody's making any money, so they're going to be like, well, why are we developing apps? Unless it's supporting something bigger that's on the desktop or something, you know, something else.
I think it was USA Today. I'm not 100% sure. They wrote about a study that was done. 62% of apps don't get launched more than a couple of times. 62%. And then there's a whole bunch. These things are downloaded and then they're forgotten. Most of them.
That's only bad for the platform providers.
Yeah, but you can't force people to use their phones more than they're already using them.
No, but you can't. You could enforce a level of quality at some point. The problem is they're gonna. It's all gonna cave in on itself, where people are gonna say, "This is ridiculous. Why would I develop an app that 40 other people have developed?
Yeah.
That are giving it away for free?" Eventually, they're hurting themselves by not putting more skin in the game.
It's exactly the same thing as in media. They're just like they're journalists working for free.
Why would you do a free? There's no benefit to a free app.
There's no benefit to writing a blog for no reason.
Absolutely is.
No, hold on. There are people who are looking for followership or whatever, but there are people who just suck at it and are writing for free anyway.
It's gonna last.
There's a few who write and do things that are.
Well, let's name names.
I'm so bad at names. I want to. Don't get me wrong. I'd love to name names. I just can't remember any. But there's, I'll give you a platform. I don't know names. I know a person, a specific person who works for this platform. Examiner.com. Examiner.com, every single person who writes for Examiner.com is not making a penny. They have a revenue sharing model, and for those who are listening, I'm assuming this is recording. I'm using the air quotes. Those who are working for them are getting a percentage of click volume on their articles. Meanwhile, they're getting a percentage of click volume on the whole platform, which is the only way to make money. These guys are then going out, promoting it to their friends. Hey, read my article. These guys don't have some other business. They're people who are into music, or I have a friend who's really into Japan, and someone else is into this thing, and they write on that subject because they want to.
They have to have either a full-time job then or something else
right.
that supports
it's a hobby.
So it's a hobby.
Right,
yeah.
And same thing with the apps. The apps are hobbies.
Why? What kind of hobby is that?
It's not for you to decide who gets to do what hobby.
No.
Some people like to code as their hobby.
Some
people like to watch you porn. There's different people with different hobbies. Who are you to decide what their
hobbies
are?
There's an end game in porn, I think.
Yeah, but you're thinking about it like a corporate guy. There has to be an end game. There has to be an ROI. There has to be this. You know what? There isn't. There are guys who are going to do that until they realize they're hungry and they want to move out of their mother's basement, and they're going to go and do something else because now it's time to grow up and date a girl for the first time in your 40s.
But then the quality of the apps go down, and so it's bad for the platform providers there as well.
I think the ones that are investing in the app development are already getting attention from Apple and from Google and from whatever. They have people that talk to Rovio all the time. They have people that talk to, all these Pocket Informant, whoever did that. They have people so they can see who's investing and who's a legitimate business, who's just a guy in a basement. And yeah, you might lose out on some things, but you know what? You lose out on stuff all the time. And if you don't miss it, you don't know it, and everyone's just fine.
Mm. Okay.
It's going to be okay. There's going to be a surplus. Because there are not enough jobs in general. There just aren't. There aren't. People are gravitating towards a place that they perceive to be growth, which is mobile. So they're going to go to mobile and they're going to launch the 100th payments app, mm-hmm. the 100th word processing app, the 1,000th game.
But they've seen this play.
Yeah.
They've seen this play out before in software.
Yeah.
And eventually it consolidates down to
it will.
A few players that are being paid.
Here's how I would think of it, Mark. I would think of every app developer as a job applicant. They are all job applicants. They are putting something out there in the hopes that not so much that they're going to make money. Maybe that was the original intention. Mm-hmm. But now, hopefully, they did a good enough job where someone from Rovio or someone from some other company goes, hey, I saw that app. Or they send the app to someone else. And now they get hired to do programming for
them. Okay, so that to me is a single developer app model where they looked at the, hopefully looked at the economic opportunity cost of developing an app versus promoting themselves through social media, for instance.
Yeah, yeah.
So I don't think the opportunity cost is good enough for that model. I think people eventually will figure that out and say, why am
I
doing this app?
Here's what I think it is. Yeah. I think it is. I don't think the resume is good enough anymore.
No, it's not. But there's other things you can do.
Like what?
Well, I consider my resume to be good. Do a Google search.
Yeah.
My name.
Same here.
Yeah. So, I mean, an app won't even show up unless your name's attached to the app somewhere in the iTunes store. I won't even show up in a Google search. So what the hell?
But it'll show up.
Who's it going to track when there's 50 other competitors?
Well, look. There, you're not going to be able to make, there are companies that have relationships and connections. So if one of these existing app developers wanted to go into your category and you're this guy who made an app, chances are they'll roll you over or they'll just buy you, pay you off, give you a few bucks, or they'll hire you. That, I think, is where a lot of them need to go and start thinking about it. So they're putting out a digital resume.
But again, that's a single developer app, which I think are in large part shitty. Whereas if you have a group of people that are coming together, you can hire the group. I mean, how do you try to figure out who did what?
But why do you care is my question.
I care because I want these platforms to succeed.
You don't have to worry about those platforms. They're doing just fine. They're doing better than you are.
Oh, that's for sure.
Yeah,
there's
no
question.
I'm not.
Nobody's crying for them right now. But I see in the future that there's going to be an issue that arises because, again, there'll be opportunity costs.
Yeah.
Do I develop for this platform where these greedy sons of bitches are taking most of the money? They never lose. Or do I go to spend my time coding on something else where they're sharing in the risk and also the return?
Do you not take a job at Apple because they're sitting on $4 billion in cash and they're not employing Americans and they're employing low-cost, low-wage workers in China? Do you not take that job?
I'm trying to follow that
analogy.
The
same thing. You say, why would I work for some greedy developer or a greedy
platform?
Because
Apple pays me, whereas the platform provider is not paying me.
Yeah, but the platform provider...
It's like I wouldn't go work for free for Apple. No, I wouldn't. Okay. Even though they've got this great company, I don't want to go work for free for them. I won't do it.
It's the modern-day version of a hot dog stand or a lemonade stand. You're putting out a lemonade stand.
But everybody is, and there's 50 others on the same street.
Well,
so why would you open up a lemonade stand on that same street?
I think eventually people realize this. We've gone through this cycle before.
Yeah.
Remember, I think during the 80s, there was this whole programmer boom where everyone, they went to a three-month course somewhere, and then they walked out a programmer. And they made real money for a little while until the software itself did all the work that they were doing. And then they weren't necessary. Same thing's happening now. These guys ran to the light, and then they found out that there were a bunch of other people already there, and they're sucking up all the light. And now they're going to go somewhere else and try to figure something
else
out.
That's right. So the platform providers will eventually they will kill the golden goose.
No, they won't. They won't. I don't think they're going to kill the golden goose at all. I think what's going to happen is the same thing that happens in any industry where you're going to have a large provider that put small providers. Let's think about the Walmart model.
Mm-hmm.
Walmart was more efficient, bigger, mm-hmm. had more categories than all of these other competitors, than Sears, than Kmart, than all these other competing stores. All those guys went belly up or couldn't compete or had to change their business model because Walmart came in and they were just that much better and more effective at
sure.
selling in those categories. The same thing here where you're going to see some people go out of business. People are still going to be able to get their groceries. They're still going to be able to get their t-shirts. They're still going to be able to get whatever it is that those suppliers previously offered.
Mm-hmm.
They're just going to have to get it at a different location, maybe fewer locations. And I don't think the provider has to pick winners. The winners will pick themselves. And you look at a better example than the Walmart one would be the mobile space. If you, not mobile, look at the telephone space before mobile became the thing. Remember how all of these long distance providers came out, and then VoIP came out. First it was the dial around numbers, then it was the VoIP numbers, and then eventually everything consolidated, and you know, ITT and all these, you know, WorldCom, and all of them just got bought up and consolidated into the Bells. And some just went out of business. But, and the same thing is going to happen now. You had this proliferation of these tiny little providers who could maybe give you a few pennies off until those pennies weren't profitable anymore. Most of them go out of business.
Yeah.
Some stay in business, but most people deal with, a big company right now. Very few still get phone service. In fact, most don't even get landline service, or at least a lot of people aren't getting it. That's how it's going to happen here. You're going to have a few large providers of apps, just like you have a few large developers of apps on Windows, just like you have a few large developers on SharePoint, just like you have a few, it's just the way of the world. You get, it's the shakeout, and these guys are being shaken out.
But I think, yeah.
But no one loses. The thing is, what ends up happening is,
nobody wins. I mean, I think the platform providers win.
The platform provider wins. That's how the game
term,
that's how the game is made, built.
No, because Microsoft built a whole organization on making sure that people that develop programs for Windows were successful. Like that's how they became big and
so
successful.
But the computer was it was a green field, and I think you're romanticizing this thing. There were tons of developers who didn't make any money. There were so many apps that were horrific for Windows.
There was not a statistic that shows that 99.99% of app developers, and this is real, do not make money. You could not apply that same statistic to software.
Well, but here's the thing. The development market has been so democratized and dumbed down and simplified from those days.
Yeah.
Those days you had to learn freaking COBOL to do anything. Now you get this cute little app development kit, and you take a few lessons on Codecademy, and you do a couple of things, and suddenly you're an app developer. And there's an easy API, there's an outreach program, there's all kinds of stuff that has made it so much easier. It's a smaller screen, you don't have to have as much functionality, a lot of the buttons already is like sort of pre-done for you. It's a different world. Before, you had to make the buttons.
Mm-hmm.
You had to make the everything that made the software run. The barrier to entry was so much more substantial. So the minute a Microsoft saw someone making any kind of effort, they're like, okay, we'll help these guys, because they put in, at least they made the buttons not look ridiculously bad.
Yeah.
That's the difference. Now it's just so easy to make something that looks good, that, you know, that flows, that has this, you know, Apple-y kind of feel to it.
Mm-hmm.
It's just gotten too easy.
So why doesn't everything go that direction?
It is. It does. There's not an industry that didn't. Everything
can't happen though in the long term, or else, like I said, people will stop making digital content because they're not making money on it, or they'll use it to create something else, like a physical product. Because how else can it all work?
Well, but that's good. That is how a marketplace is supposed to work, where you're going to attract people to this is the theory of competition.
You could have a tulip mania that develops in this market, and it all comes crashing down like a house of cards. The mortgage market was like that.
Well, I use a different paradigm to look at this particular situation, and that is the pure competition theory. Competition theory says that if you have outsized margins in your business, that is going to attract competition.
Sure.
And barring any artificial barriers like legislation, like some other huge cost that is insurmountable, or other things that just keep you out, you are going to see competition enter that business until those margins are driven down, and then competitors stop entering the business because now there's no more, and they go pursue something else that is more attractive. That is exactly what's happening. It's pure marketplace economics that exists in every business, except it hasn't really existed in financial services. And you brought that up. I think that's a good point. But the reason is legislation has kept them and their ties to government have actually created a barrier to entry. No one can afford to start a financial services company if they're going to comply with all the laws and regulations that have been piled into the industry. And that's what has kept it from being competitive at all. And these guys, on top of that, also get into government. Everyone in Goldman Sachs, the last few treasury secretaries and so on, they all had ties to major investment banks. And they donate tons of money to campaigns. And they're the only ones who understand the finance that they've helped make that complicated. And this regulatory cycle actually helps them. They complain about it, but they don't really complain about it because they know they can afford an entire department of legislation.
Sarbanes.
They can afford a Sarbanes-Oxley department. Yeah. Whereas if you're going to try to start a brokerage, you can't.
You don't need to comply, I think, unless you have 50 employees. But eventually, you need to.
Well, but that's what's happening in the payments business now. The payments business has been inordinately successful because building that network was a barrier to entry. So once you build this three-party system where you've got stores signed up, you've got banks issuing cards, you've got the network that's processing it, and then you've got the customers that have the cards. You have these four parties ingrained into a network. That's a huge barrier to entry. But now you have people like Square coming in, and they're going, well, screw that. Or you have PayPal that came in the last generation, and what they're seeing, what they said is, look, we're going to do it in a completely different way, where you don't hit a bank account, where you don't hit this other account, where they're trying to circumvent this archaic system, and they're going to see success, I think, because they're not tied to those old models. That's what these app providers are going to have to do. Go create your own platform.
Yeah.
Go create your own open, or you know what? Use an open source platform. Why don't you create an open source version of iOS or your own Linux based, because Apple is basically a Linux based operating system. Go build on top of Linux, make your own, and then you'll have a whole new green field on which you can develop.
Yeah, but they also try to most open source companies try to monetize, through services.
They do.
Or
they do. Red Hat,
some kind of a premium option.
Yeah.
So they're in business for money, and I still say the majority of those make money versus the majority of app developers don't. So I don't. I see it as something that it's going to come back and bite the platform.
I disagree.
You can't have an ecosystem where 99.9% of the companies aren't making money.
No, you can. They're going to go away.
That economy is not going to work.
They're going to go away.
Fine. They go away. But that just means that you've now reduced the total size of your app market to something that's...
No.
So you think the strong will survive and it won't have any impact on the platform?
Absolutely not. Because... you will still have a situation where people have only so much time. Mm-hmm. They have only so much capacity on their phone.
Yeah.
Their phone usage is only so much. They're only going to use so many apps. There is a surplus right now. It has to get shaken out. And, and the way that shakeout is going to happen is people have to not make money. And by not making money, that forces you to find some place where you do make money.
Yeah.
And it has to happen. There's an oversupply. And just like right now, when you in journalism, there's a lot of people writing. Hopefully most of them are doing it as a hobby, because if they're relying on it to make a living, that's going to be really tough.
So what happened to Wang Computer? What happened to IBM OS 2? What happened to the competing platforms?
Well, those are
Microsoft
bad
Windows.
Strategic decisions. Those are bad. That's bad strategy.
But I'm telling
that's
you, this
different.
Is bad strategy too.
No.
There
no.
will be one app store that's left over in the consumer space, the mobile space, and it'll probably be Android.
There might be a
small number two, which will be Apple. But everyone else is going away. It's the same thing that's going to happen. And the one that makes sure that the app developers are successful, and in last generation was Microsoft, are going to be the ones that end up winning here. It's our this model. I've already seen this happen. It's going to happen the same exact way.
I don't see it. I think the shakeout needs to happen. I agree on the platform side. There will be three platforms maximum, and I think there will be a dominant one.
We've never had three platforms before.
You had Unix in the B2B space. You
Where's
had Windows,
Unix
and you had Apple.
Where's Unix today?
Well,
you have
Unix.
You have Linux, Apple, and Microsoft. Okay.
Yeah, so you have three.
So you have three.
You could have three here. There's room for three. Maybe not all of them won't have equal share. I think just the sheer volume of support that Android gets because they're pricing it at free. Although they're paying, actually, I think Microsoft is making more money off of Android than Google is. Well, because they threatened to sue all these companies like Samsung and LG, and all of them settled with Microsoft. So now Microsoft is making, I think it was like $2 off every phone that's sold with an Android operating system.
Wow.
You didn't know that?
No, what was the lawsuit about?
They weren't lawsuits. They had IP. They threatened to sue HTC.
Oh, so they were using Microsoft's IP
that,
to develop.
Well, they claimed. And they didn't want to go, these companies didn't want to go litigate. The way they settled it was by paying them royalty on every set. I forgot what the number was. Wow. $1.50, $2.
There must have been some claim, legitimate claim. Yeah.
There may have been some legitimate software, but listen, these things, when you take them to court, it's expensive,
yeah.
And
HTC is not a small company.
HTC is not a small company, but they didn't want to go to battle with Microsoft, and Microsoft didn't want to sue Google, so instead they threatened the providers, the sellers of the phones, instead of going directly after Google.
I mean, but there must have been some basis. That's my...
Well, whatever the basis is, the threat or the perception of basis was enough to get them to settle and pay them money.
Yeah, maybe they thought, they probably looked at it as a risk analysis and said, we have 40% chance of losing here, it's better just to pay it.
Hope you enjoyed this episode of Idea Factory Radio. There's going to be a brand new, shiny one next week. Don't forget to sign up on ideafactory.com. It's factory with a K, not a C. There's going to be all kinds of outtakes for people who log into the website. Usually scandalous stuff we can include in the main podcast. So see you next week. Bye. It's a long